Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Very glad to have you listening this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we're going to spend some time talking about how it is that we think about and talk about the Holocaust here in this country. And our guest is a scholar who's written about this and has talked about it quite a lot. His name is Peter Novick. He is Professor Emeritus of History at University of Chicago. He's taught there at Chicago since 1966. He's authored several books, and his most recent, one that has caused a lot of conversation and debate, is The Holocaust in American Life. It was published in 1999. And we'll talk about some of the ideas, try to talk about some of the ideas in the book. He's here visiting the campus. He gave a talk in the MillerCom series last night. And there will be another event that I want to mention, so people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana might like to attend. This is a panel discussion on the politics and culture of memory, and they're titling it The Future of the Holocaust. And it will involve several people, our guest Peter Novick, also Dan Diener from University of Leipzig. He has a number of affiliations, but at the moment he is George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor and International Council Visiting Professor here at University of Illinois. In fact, he'll be on this program next week. He'll be on this panel, Michael Rothberg, who teaches in the English department, and Peter Fritschi, who is also an historian at U of I, will chair this panel discussion. It'll be taking place at the Levis Faculty Center, 7:30 this evening on the third floor, and anyone who is interested in attending is certainly welcome to do that. As we talk here this morning, questions, comments are welcome. We encourage people to call in. Oh, of course, we ask people just to try to be brief so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to participate by calling. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here and giving some of your time.
Glad to be here.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what I understand to be some of the basic arguments in Holocaust in American Life. Starting with the idea that it apparently had been the prevailing sort of idea that after the war, at the time when the Holocaust was still a matter of recent memory, people, it was something that was so... It was so horrible. It was just, it was pretty much too much for people to think about.
And I don't agree.
Okay.
Let me start off by being contentious.
I mean, I guess that's sort of saying that that had been sort of the prevailing view. And that was the way that people had talked about it.
Sorry.
And that you're coming along and you're saying, right, okay. So they're saying that this had been, and maybe in some people's minds still is, just this idea that, you know, it was so horrible that people didn't, they felt that it's something they couldn't deal with.
Yes.
And that they wanted to put behind them. And what you're one of the things, the place I think you begin in the book is by suggesting a different approach. Two things, that on one level, nationally, our policy was going in a different direction. We were done with Hitler. We were moving on to something else. But also making the argument that American Jews were interested in a particular kind of image, that is the image of being successful and being Americans. And perhaps also for that reason, American Jews were essentially wanting to move on. And this is a new way of thinking about how people were thinking about it at that time.
Right. And I apologize for jumping down your throat.
That's okay.
Before. Yeah, I think that's true. There are a lot of different things going on. For one thing, during the Second World War, people did not perceive this separate hard-edged object called the Holocaust. The murder of European Jews was perceived at the time as simply the Jewish dimension of Nazi barbarism in general. Hmm. So that it wasn't reified, made into a separate object. It's not a question of one view or the other being right or wrong. It's just different ways of looking at it. It's also true, as you remarked, that after the war, with astonishing rapidity, there was this reversal of alliances, and we went from being allied with the Soviet Union against Germany to being allied with a revived Germany against the Soviet Union. In 1945, Americans had cheered as the Red Army bombed Berlin into rubble. In 1948, we were cheering gallant Berliners who were resisting the Red Army. So it was no longer useful for in the national interest to dwell on the crimes of Nazism or the crimes of the Germans, our new ally. It is also true that American Jews were interested in integrating into the United States. Anti-Semitism, which had been really fairly high before and during the war, started to drop very rapidly after 1945. And in the face of a disposition to treat Jews as no different than other Americans, it seemed foolish to say, no, we are different, as the Holocaust demonstrated. I mean, that was simply not what was on the agenda. One might also say that nowadays, the last 15 or 20 years, there has been a kind of, I don't want to say celebration of the status of victim, but it's positively regarded. But in post-war America, still in a victory culture, a military culture, a cowboy culture, the victim status was something that received at best the kind of sympathy not unmixed with contempt. I mean, being a winner, being a hero was what people wanted to be. So there were all sorts of ways in which there simply was not any group of people in the United States who much wanted to talk about it. There were some survivors of the Holocaust in the United States, perhaps 100,000, but this, in a country of a couple hundred million, this is a tiny drop in the bucket. These were, by and large, young people, didn't know English very well. They weren't even that well integrated to start with within the American Jewish community. Some of them were perfectly willing to talk about it, but nobody much wanted to listen. So there... Memory, I guess I would say, is not natural, or a collectivity does not turn something into a collective memory automatically. There has to be a reason, and in this case, there were reasons. There was no particular reason to do it, and lots of reasons not to do it.
Well, then you go on and explain that how things changed perhaps in the 1960s. And that now we're at a point where the big change is that for a great many American Jews, this event has central significance. It has a lot to do with how it is they define themselves. Now, this is a very big change over a seemingly relatively short period of time.
No, it is a big change, and I think, excuse me. Begins in the late 60s, even more in the 70s, in response to a variety of things. I'll mention a few of them briefly. Concern for the security of Israel, particularly after the 1973 Yom Kippur War, is terribly important. Israel almost loses the war in 1973, takes very serious casualties. There is a disposition to regard Israel as being in what might call proto-Holocaustal straits, and to frame events in the Middle East within a Holocaust paradigm. The Arabs as the new Nazis. There is also there comes to be within American Jewry a great deal of survival anxiety, not physical survival against some military or murderous menace, but demographic survival against the assimilation, intermarriage. And as we all know, from the 60s onward, increasing in the 70s and 80s, the growth of particularist identities, particular group consciousness is a big thing. Well, as American Jews ask themselves what they had in common, what distinguished them from other Americans, it was a little hard to specify what it was. They couldn't distinguish themselves on the basis of distinctive religious beliefs, because most American Jews simply didn't have distinctive religious beliefs. They couldn't distinguish themselves on the basis of shared cultural traits. Most American Jews didn't have these either. There was their support of Israel, but it was of a fairly thin nature. The one thing that all American Jews did have in common was that, but for the happy accident of grandparents or great-grandparents' immigration, they would have shared the fate of European Jewry. So in this way, the Holocaust symbolically became the center of, for many, I certainly don't want to say for everybody, and least of all for the most religious. After all, for the most religious, there was Judaism, there was Jewish religious practice. But most American Jews are not that religious, so there had to be some secular alternative on which to ground identity. And it turns out, this is very hard to measure, but there was a recent survey by the American Jewish Committee in which American Jews were asked to, were presented with a list of activities: going to synagogue, observing Jewish holidays, visiting Israel, and commemorating the Holocaust, and asked which of these listed activities are most important to your Jewish identity. And commemorating the Holocaust won hands down, beating out any of the others. Now, as I say, I'm a little skeptical about how significant these kind of findings are, but they're certainly interesting.
Yeah. Well, then, moving on to what seems to me the point where there's the most controversy, or perhaps the thing that upset people, was your argument that this preoccupation with the Holocaust, having it be such an important point for American Jews to define themselves, it's not healthy.
So it seems to me, and so it seems to many others, but of course there are others who disagree. One of the interesting things that I've discovered in the couple of years since the book came out, and just as I'm visiting the University of Illinois yesterday and today, I've been traveling all around the country speaking to groups about the book over the last couple of years. And what is so interesting is that interesting because I am myself completely without religion and almost a caricature of secularity. The people who are most enthusiastic about my book, by and large, are the most religious because they are so distressed that a kind of pseudo-religion of the Holocaust is driving out traditional Jewish religion. Mm-hmm. So this is a very large portion of those who share my distress. My own distress is, I don't know, I guess you'd call it secular. I don't think that it's healthy for any group to think of themselves as essentially victims. I don't think it's healthy for blacks. I don't think it's healthy for Hispanics. I don't think it's healthy for Jews. And particularly in the case of American Jews, who are in no sense victims, I think it's a kind of false consciousness which I criticize.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Peter Novick. He's Professor Emeritus of History at University of Chicago, and as I mentioned at the beginning, has taught at Chicago since 1966. Some of the ideas here we're discussing in brief form can be examined at greater length in his book, The Holocaust in American Life. It was published in 1999. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. And questions, comments are welcome. We have a couple of people ready to go already. Again, as I often try to say, we'd encourage people just to try to be brief in their comments. And we do that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep things moving along. But anyone certainly is welcome to participate in the conversation here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, both in Champaign. We'll start with first person in line on line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to bring up a couple of what I think of issues related to this and hear the comments. I will talk from my own experience in part because I grew up with a number of survivors and their children, a large number of survivors. And I want to say that my perception, certainly in the 50s and the 60s, is these survivors for a long time were much too traumatized to talk about their experience in the camps. Even to talk about it with their family, much less to talk about it with anyone else, and much less to make anything of it. And their attempt was always to distance themselves from their memories, which were much too painful, which caused all sorts of psychological and physical difficulties. It's only as their children grow up, children either born right after the war in Europe or born in America, that we start having some willingness even within the families to talk about it at length. And then you also have all sorts of children of survivors issues beginning to come up as they become adults. In the 60s and 70s, you were talking about the number of issues, but I want to bring up that it seems to me that at least in the Jewish communities and certainly in the Jewish communities of survivors, that there was increased perception of anti-Semitism in the United States, particularly related to issues of the anti-Israeli feelings, particularly on the left, on those in political left, even those who in the past had been connected to or had some affiliation with the Jewish community, and also increased anti-Semitism in the black, or at least perceived in anti-Semitism, let me say it that way, in the black civil rights movement. And I think all of those factors are important in the increased interest and exploration of the Holocaust in the 60s and 70s, and it seems that that's something that at least I haven't heard you talk about. I haven't read your book, so I'll, put that aside. But I'd be interested to hear your comments on that.
Well, yeah. excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. So far as the your first point and survivors' reluctance to talk about their experiences, it's a very mixed picture. And depending on sort of what part of the elephant you touch, you get a very different impression. There certainly were. There is no question that there were survivors for whom the memories were too painful to bring to the surface and did not speak to their children, etc. At the same time, and sort of coexisting with this, we have abundant testimony of survivors, both in this country and in Israel, who were anxious to talk about their experiences, but found that other people didn't want to listen to them, and just to avoid, you know, being regarded as a pain, stopped talking about it. So it's a very mixed picture. But I certainly would not for a moment deny that there were people like those whom you described. What the balance was between these two, I think it's impossible to say. Your second point, I think, is absolutely right. I do discuss it in the book. An increased perception of anti-Semitism in the United States. I think the perception was wrong. I do not think that there was any substantial increase in anti-Semitism in the United States. Was part of that mindset, part of that worldview, which led to a lot more talk about the Holocaust. Also, in as you say, also the perception of increased anti-Semitism among blacks. My own view, you can see it, you know, sort of expanded and spelled out in the book, is that there really was less here than met the eye, and that a great deal was being made out of very little. But as far as perception is concerned, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, if I could just go take one step further, and then I'll get off the phone and let others. One of the things that I think also developed, along with the focus on the Holocaust, was increase of movements on the right in the Jewish community and outside the Jewish communities. Particularly, I can think of my own personal experience that many of those attracted to movements such as the more extreme JDL and other Jewish nationalist movements of various sorts grew out of that increased perception of anti-Semitism and increased feeling that this is what wasn't responded to before the Holocaust, and now we have to respond to it otherwise, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I agree completely. The JDL, the Jewish Defense League, is particularly interesting in this regard. The slogan "Never Again," which has become so common, so popular, used so widely, was in fact originally a Jewish Defense League slogan invoked in conflicts with blacks in New York City. And one of the things I discovered as I looked through organizational records in the 1960s and 70s is that many of the mainstream Jewish organizations were distressed by the way in which the Jewish Defense League was growing by this invocation of the Holocaust and seemed to be establishing a kind of rhetorical monopoly over the Holocaust. And part of the Holocaust programming and talking more about the Holocaust on the part of mainstream Jewish organizations was not to let the Jewish Defense League maintain this monopoly.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. And have some other folks here, and I want to continue. We'll go next to another Champagne person, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As a Jew who's operated more within Jewish institutions, both religious and secular, I don't think it's been a consensual process or a kind of a populist process by which the Holocaust has become so central to our lives. I think basically it's been forced down our throats. It's been forced down our throats primarily by Israel. It's been forced down our throats by Jewish leaders in this country for any number of reasons, from ideological reasons to fundraising reasons. And it's been forced down our throats increasingly by elites in this country who, it's almost as if they want to feel that Holocausts were victims from within this country, not in Europe, and also who perhaps, you know, have their own political agenda, or who definitely have their own political agenda for tying the innocence of Holocaust victims to the increasingly implausible innocence of the United States against people like Castro or during the Cold War or so forth. But I don't think this particular version of the Holocaust that's been forced down our throats is at all a scholarly version of the Holocaust. I mean, I think that's what you're arguing. In fact, there really isn't much interest in Holocaust historical scholarship. I've never seen a debate related to the Historiker Streit in Germany or to the Goldhagen book or to the charge, you know, the back and forth charges that are made about the Holocaust. It's all this conversation about the Holocaust is really fairly programmed from the top down just to create certain political environment for the support of Israel, and as the last caller pointed out, for Jewish antipathy towards black interests in this country, completely manufactured in the 1960s and 1970s.
I'm going to have to disagree pretty thoroughly with this caller. I think it's fair to characterize the views he's expressed as a kind of conspiracy theory of Israeli elites, Israeli hawks, Jewish leaders, anti-black sentiment on the part of Jewish leaders. I think that's wrong. In any case, much too simple. The relationship between leaders and followers, between leaders and their constituencies, is a very complicated and reciprocal one. Jews, sort of the Jew in the street, whatever, there's a sort of average Jew, to some extent is going to take some guidance from leaders. At the same time, leaders become leaders, continue to be leaders by expressing views that are found among their constituents. There was a time, it is perfectly true, that there was a time, particularly in the mid-1970s, when there was a kind of heavy invocation of Holocaust rhetoric on behalf of in defense of Israel, on behalf of a hawkish position in Israel. I think that was already declining by the end of the 70s. By the 1980s, was declining still further, and nowadays is simply gone.
But you say you're not within Jewish life, and I am within Jewish life. And I'm telling you, it's not gone. It's there. It's there every day. I experience it.
I don't know. I don't know what being not within Jewish life. When did I say I am not within?
You said you weren't a practicing Jew in any way.
I said I was a caricature of secularity. There are many ways of being a Jew besides being religious.
Well, yes, and that's fine. And even from within secular Jewish life, the connection between the Holocaust and support for Israel is constantly and incessantly made.
Well, you know, what can I say except we differ in our reading of the sources. I'm really not trying to pull rank as an academic or a scholar, but I spent about 10 years going very carefully through Jewish and other discourses about the Holocaust over the last half century, and it seems to me the salience of this discourse with respect to the Middle East has declined precipitously, continuously since the 1970s. You read it differently, and this is not the kind of dispute that's going to be fruitful.
Okay. You know, there was a LexisNexis search done on the New York Times. In 1999, there was over 700 articles about the Holocaust. In that same year, there was 30 articles about Africa. I mean, what do you explain?
This is perfectly...
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, first of all. I'm definitely not a conspiracy theorist. It's just when one begins to delve into Israel, American support for Israel, and American Jewish support for Israel, and then one puts that alongside this incessant clamoring about the Holocaust and constant articles about musical instruments and paintings and everything else, and then the constant invocation of Jews being under siege in Israel, of there being an incipient Holocaust, of Jews being driven into the sea. You know, I don't see how you could fail to see the relationship between those two, between all this rhetoric.
I guess what I would say is that in the origin of widespread talk about the Holocaust in the United States, I think support of Israel was important. Since then, I think once set in motion, this has declined. In fact, it is the case that there are many Israelis who are resistant to all of this American Jewish talk about the Holocaust, which they feel takes place at the expense of support of Israel, that the Holocaust has become, in their view, and I think there's something to this, an alternative to Israel as the center of Jewish loyalty and Jewish identity, and they're very troubled by this. So there's this paradoxical situation in that the Holocaust may have first come to prominence in within American Jewry, in large part to mobilize support for Israel. Over the course of 20 years, it has come to some substantial extent to replace Israel in American Jewish consciousness.
I must jump in again. I hope the caller forgive me, but we're already past our midpoint. The lines are full, and I do want to give some other callers a chance to get into the conversation here too. And let me again mention that our guest is Peter Novick. He's Professor Emeritus of History at University of Chicago. If you'd like to read more of his thinking on the subject, you can look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled The Holocaust in American Life, published in 1999. Also, I do want to mention that there will be a panel discussion, I'm sure, dealing with these issues and others, The Future of the Holocaust, a panel discussion on the politics and culture of memory. Our guest, Peter Novick, will be one of the participants, and that will be taking place tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus on the third floor. It's free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And we will continue here. Our next caller is in Urbana. It's line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm not Jewish. I haven't read the book. I'm not particularly well informed on this. But as an outsider, the thing that strikes me is the way in which it seems that the Holocaust and the suffering that the Jews underwent during the Holocaust is used to justify in some way policies in Israel toward Arabs, which it seems to me cause great suffering among Arabs and Muslims. And that's a little bit backward from the way I would have hoped it might be, that Jews would be more aware of suffering of other groups because of the Holocaust. And my guess is you've dealt with this in your book, and I'll hang up and you can talk to that point. Thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah, it is. excuse me. It's a bad day to be on the radio with a frog in my throat. In part, I agree with you. It is certainly true that again, particularly in the 1970s and the early 1980s, there was fairly widespread in a lot of Israeli discourse, a kind of self-righteousness based on the Holocaust, the invocation of the Holocaust in the 1982 Lebanon War, for example. Then Prime Minister Begin talked about Yasser Arafat in Beirut as being like Hitler in his bunker in Berlin. At the same time, it was used in the other direction as well. And there were many on the Israeli left, in the Israeli peace movement, who explicitly invoked the Holocaust and the Jewish experience with foreign oppression and occupation in order to argue for a more liberal and a more peaceful policy. That there are people within Israel, within the Jewish community, who do in fact use the Holocaust in order to justify Israeli policies is perfectly true. I would say here that the problem is that the only historical maxim I know that's really useful is if you can imagine it, somebody will do it. So you know, there is always an example of anything you want to talk about. The question is this widespread? Is this dominant? Does this define the present use of the Holocaust? And my sense, as I said to the last caller, is that whereas once upon a time it played a rather significant role, I don't think it does anymore.
All right, let's go to Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I will associate myself with the remarks of the latter two callers. I really think that maybe it's just sub rosa that you don't even have to make the arguments anymore, and maybe that's why they aren't as present in the press or something. But I think that's something that we can leave in the air for the moment. I actually wanted to try to approach the idea of the exceptionalism of it. I don't know if you treat that, but and what I mean by that is that, of course, there was the particularity of European anti-Semitism that underlie the death camps, but even the death camps weren't just for Jews. I mean, there were the Ubermensch and the Untermensch. So it seems to me that we just have the clip, the Holocaust, and it's always, this is not something that's not also been unremarked upon, the fact that, there are 6 million Jews and 3 million others in the death camps and other ways too, but so it wasn't, and again, not to take away the particularity of anti-Semitism, but the way it's used in the language here, it only means the one thing, and I think that's a shame, and somehow I wanted to raise the idea that on college campuses, we have this attack on particularity, let's say identity politics, which I have some critiques of. But at the same time, the people that kind of use just any kind of acknowledgement of difference as some kind of, in itself a racist kind of thing, like Jewish studies should stand right next to the other cultural studies. And I don't mean that in a way that it's used a lot, but I'll just have to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, here's the point. I think actually you agree with the caller.
I'm sorry to be an academic. Yes and no. There is, to my mind, a really very foolish and unproductive discussion. Is the real number of Holocaust victims 6 million or 11 million? This caller suggested 9, but it's more common to say, does the Holocaust consist of the 6 million Jews who were killed or 6 million Jews plus 5 million non-Jews? This is a purely definitional question. There was an onslaught against European Jews. There were others who were also targeted, depending on your particular purposes and the subject you're talking about. It may be useful to talk about it one way or the other, but it's not as if one is right and the other is wrong. If your point, as it may be, is that there is sometimes a certain possessiveness in some Jewish discourse, which resents the mention or the inclusion of non-Jewish victims of Nazism in the same breath with talk of Jewish victims. Yes, that is regrettably the case. I think that most leaders of American Jewry try to steer clear of that kind of talk, but by no means all do. With respect to your remarks about Jewish studies and other ethnic studies, I confess I didn't really get the point.
Well, let me ask an equally problematic question, I guess, because you are suggesting to people that we should be careful. We should be careful about the kinds of words we use and how we talk about the Holocaust, because on the one hand, there will be those people who would say that this was and you talked about this last night in your talk. This was an event unique in human history. There just simply wasn't ever anything else like this. And then there will be people who say, but there we can point throughout history to many examples of genocide. And the other, I suppose, the other extreme point would be the person who would say the question is not how this could have happened, but how is it that it keeps happening? How does one steer, though, the appropriate course and between, I think, the two points? Because I think one doesn't want to do either. You don't want to say, yes, and it's in fact there was nothing ever like the Holocaust and then maybe there never will be again, or that this, or that you're saying that it happens every day.
You know, I again, realizing I'm a caricature of the professor, I don't accept the notion of steering a correct course between these two. For example, David, you and I, are we more alike than different? There are all, you could make a very long list of all the ways in which we are alike, all the things we share. You could make a very long list of all the ways in which we're different. Which list is more important? How does one steer a course between talking about the similarities and talking about the differences? I think it's a foolish project. For some purposes, it might be, depending on what we're trying to do, it might be useful to talk about the similarities. For other purposes, it might be useful to talk about the differences. There is no dual correct course between the two.
All right. I'll just go on to another call. To Belgium, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I take exception with what you said about this being a single event in world history, because if you point to the aspect of Mesoamerica and North America upon the emergence of northern Europeans into this area, yes, there were 6 million Jews killed, or whatever number you want to use, but there were still some Jews left in the world. We can take the example of many, many Native American peoples who no longer exist for the plain and simple reason that Jesuits wanted to change them into Christians. But that's another topic. The aspect of the Holocaust and Israel is interesting in that any time that I point out to other people that I take exception with some of the policies of Israel, I'm immediately called anti-Semitic. And I'm not being anti-Semitic. I'm pointing out that we need a very equal policy on both sides, and it'd probably help a whole lot. But the American Jewish community that has immigrated into Israel has so polarized the situation there and moved right into the very heart of the Palestinians and really exacerbated the problem. It seems to me that we could really solve some of that problem if we didn't get some of the immigrants that are really causing a great deal of the problem in Israel to just back off, though I know that's almost impossible to do. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I don't know. You can comment on anything you want.
Yeah, well, there are many... Or at least a couple of different parts to it. So far as the caller's suggestion that there are many other examples of genocidal programs in history, he is absolutely right. I don't. And insofar as what is bothering him, what he is objecting to, is what I called before a certain possessiveness and a certain desire for primacy for those who talk about the Holocaust. Our catastrophe is incomparable and is not to be spoken of together with other people's catastrophe. I think that's terrible stuff. I think that's bad stuff. I think we should have nothing to do with it. So far as he repeats what other callers have said about the Holocaust being used to justify Israeli policies, I can only repeat what I've said before. Sometimes I don't think it's as central as he does. He suggests that many American Jewish immigrants to Israel have been among the most hawkish and belligerent settlers. This turns out to be true. I mean, once upon a time, there were American labor Zionists who went to Israel to participate in the building of this new social experiment. Most American immigrants, not all, but most American immigrants to Israel in recent years have been among the ultra-Orthodox who have been very, very active in expanding settlements in the West Bank. I wish it didn't happen. I disapprove. I don't like it. I don't know what more to say than that. Mm-hmm.
We have about 6 or 7 minutes left. Again, another caller. We'll go to Clifton. It's line number 4. Hello.
Yes, doctor. I'm a World War II veteran. I served in the Pacific. But there's a lot of injustices, and I call it, of course, it's been said, man's inhumanity to man. It don't make any difference to me who's doing it to who. But this was a terrible thing. But one thing I want to bring out is that we tell the truth and tell it how it was. I get a little upset when they don't want to tell about the atomic bomb. They wouldn't put it on the postage stamp in 1945, and so many things that it seems like we just want to sweep under the rug. And I never will forget going to Dachau about 4 years ago, and I saw that in four languages there it says "never again." Of course, in German and English and Yiddish, and I don't know what the other language is, French or whatever. But anyway, we killed 53,400,000 people in World War II, and that's just what was killed. And I just hope that we can stop this. But one thing I want to say is we don't stop it by not being militarily prepared. So I'll stop right there and see what you got to say.
I guess I'm going to have to disqualify myself on questions of military policy. I think I'm going to have to stop there.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're coming down to the point where we're going to have to stop. We have a couple of minutes left, and I'll be the student again, and you can be the professor. We now in Washington, D.C. have a Holocaust museum. Would it serve us any purpose if we said, well, that's fine. It's probably a good thing that we have a Holocaust museum, but we ought to find extra space on the mall for the Museum of the Armenian Genocide and the Museum for all the people Stalin killed and the Museum for all the people Pol Pot killed. And then while we're at it, we better deal with slavery. And then while we're at that, we better deal with the genocide of indigenous peoples of the Americas. And pretty soon we wouldn't have room for another building because we'd have so many. What's the function of places like that? And does it do anything for us that we have them?
The people who worked to construct the Holocaust Museum believed sincerely, continue to believe, that the kind of confrontation with the horrors of the Holocaust that the museum provides is going to have moral consequences, is going to, in some ways, energize people to be alert to take action about other atrocities in the here and now. I'm not sure that happens. I'm not sure that it doesn't, but I don't know what the evidence is that it does. You mention, and I think it's very important, the absence of a museum in Washington to American black slavery. It really seems to me striking that we have this enormous museum of the Holocaust in Washington and none to slavery, which, of course, is the great disfiguring atrocity of American history. It seems to me that it is as if the Germans said, well, the Holocaust was really a terrible, terrible thing, but what's really important is that we build in Berlin a museum about American black slavery. I think if the Germans did that, we would think something very, very peculiar was going on. It seems to me what's going on is something analogous to that.
Well, do indeed the Germans think that it's peculiar that we here in the United States, in Washington, D.C., we have a Holocaust museum?
Well, you say, do Germans think this? It's like asking what Americans think. No, I'm, again, I'm being the professor. No, obviously some do. Some I've talked with do.
I don't know where I am, but maybe that's with a topic like this. That's an appropriate admission to make. I wonder how you think about the fact that I guess some people I'm sure reacted to the Holocaust in American life as if you were almost as if you were denying it. Not so much that you were denying,
but
you were saying that as if you were saying, well, it's not as important as maybe you think.
It is true that there are people who responded that way. Part of it, again, being the professor, has to do with whether you think about collective memory as something that arises spontaneously and naturally, or whether you think of collective memories as the result of choices by collectivities about what it is useful to remember for present purposes. And going back to the beginning of our discussion about the reasons why the Holocaust was not talked about originally and came to be talked about later. I think a lot of the people who are upset by my book are upset by the fact that I talk about this as to a very considerable extent involving deliberate choice. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But for those who regard it as a kind of natural and spontaneous development, to talk about it as the result of deliberate choice sounds as if I'm saying something disparaging about it.
We will have to stop there. I want to mention again, if people are interested in reading on the subject, you can look for this book that we have mentioned. It's titled The Holocaust in American Life. It was published in 1999 by our guest, Peter Novick. He's Professor Emeritus of History at University of Chicago. He's visiting here the campus and will be taking part in this panel discussion about the future of the Holocaust tonight, 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. And anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Enjoyed it.
Today's broadcast made possible with support from Corley Photography at 118 North Walnut in Champaign, providing portrait, wedding, and commercial photography service, plus the copying and restoration of old photos.